Thanks for inviting me into your home, your long-haul truck, taxi, RV, camper, your parents' basement, your loft, that greasy spoon just off the interstate, and your cabin in the woods. Welcome to Coast AM. I'm Richard Serrett, and tonight, this morning, we're coming to you live from Coast's Toronto affiliate talk radio, AM 640, where the roads are sloppy, but could easily turn more than a little dicey if the temperature were to drop a few more degrees. Then sloppy turns to icy, and that's not good. So I hope wherever you are, you're warm and safe. It's a great night after you've shoveled the drive for the fourth time to settle in and listen to the radio. And tonight, this morning, I'm confident Coast is going to be great company. Tonight's special word of the day is suppressed. It's one of those words that gets tossed around, especially on programs like this. Here's the actual dictionary definition. Suppressed, kept from public knowledge by various means, smothered, stifled, strangled, held in check with difficulty. Suppressed. The word is going to reverberate throughout the next 4 hours. The word suppressed is in the subtitle of Xavier Haas's book, Suppressed Evidence and the Hidden History of a Lost Race. That lost race refers to ancient giants of the Americas. That's a subject that has enthralled me since I attended Sunday school and heard about the various giants that inhabited the Old Testament. Og, king of Bashan, who was said to be 14 feet tall. Whole tribes of giants like the Amorites and the Amalekites, the Emim and the Zuzim. It seems these giants, once driven out of Canaan, somehow, according to legend, found their way to North America and into the legends and lore of numerous indigenous cultures here. Despite scores of reports that giant skeletal remains were unearthed in burial mounds up and down the Ohio Valley, for example, mysteriously, not one of those hundreds of giant skeletons found its way to the Smithsonian or any other of the great museums across North America, at least not for public consumption. And this is because, says my guest in Hour 3 and 4, the evidence has been suppressed. He'll take us on a tour of the Americas looking for evidence of a lost race of incredibly tall humans. From the accounts of early explorers to archaeological finds and searching through the archives, he'll lay out the case that a race of giants once inhabited the Americas and raised some uncomfortable questions that have yet to be answered by academia. Hitting leadoff, if you'll allow me a baseball reference in mid-December, more suppression, this time at the hands of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. And who or what did NASA suppress? Well, it involves a controversial research paper written by a renowned scientist at Stanford University that was funded by a NASA research grant, a paper that concludes ancient alien intervention may have sparked human civilization. That NASA or the Pentagon would engage in suppressing or burying a scientific paper that concludes ancient aliens visited our planet and played a significant role in the evolution of our species may not come as a complete shock to listeners of this program. But what may surprise you is the identity of the author of this controversial paper, particularly since this man, known affectionately as the People's Scientist, arguably the best-known scientist on the planet, would later argue that the chances of extraterrestrial spacecraft visiting Earth, either in the present or distant past, are vanishingly small. Those words, in fact, were uttered in the 1980 PBS series Cosmos by, you guessed it, Dr. Carl Sagan. And yet, the late Dr. Sagan, astronomer, cosmologist, astrophysicist, astrobiologist, author, science popularizer, and science communicator, wrote an obscure scientific paper in 1962 that, quote, reveals a comprehensive model of ancient alienism that adheres to all the rules and strictures of the scientific method. It was peer-reviewed and published in the respected scientific journal Planetary and Space Science, after which it effectively disappeared. No one spoke of it, no one critiqued it, and no one referenced it. Over the next 30 years, Sagan became famous, and nothing was ever said of that paper. Sagan became an ardent skeptic of the ancient alien theory, UFOs, and in particular the alien abduction phenomenon. And yet, secretly, he continued to believe with great passion until his death in 1996 at the age of 62 in the existence of interstellar spaceflight and past alien visitations to Earth. Donald L. Zygutis, the author of The Sagan Conspiracy, NASA's Untold Plot to Suppress the People Scientists' Theory of Ancient Aliens, is next. Suppression, our watchword for the next 4 hours. As the Irish newspaper publisher Lord Northcliffe said, news is what somebody somewhere wants to suppress. All the rest is advertising. So come on in, wary stranger. Hang your cloak on a peg, grab a stool, and come gather round the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. I'm Richard Serrett. This is Coast to Coast AM. Why don't you stay a while? Donald L. Zygutis is a graduate of Corbin University and has 40 years of experience investigating and analyzing the life and work of Carl Sagan as a leading skeptic and ETI theorist. He resides in Bend, Oregon. He is the author of The Sagan Conspiracy, NASA's Untold Plot to Suppress the People Scientists' Theory of Ancient Aliens. Donald, welcome to Coast AM. How are you?
I'm doing great, Richard. That was a great introduction, and it's an honor to be on your show.
The pleasure is mine. Take us back to 1962, Berkeley, this paper that Sagan was working on. What is the genesis of this paper? How did it come to be?
The paper that Sagan wrote was funded, as you said, by a NASA grant. At that time, there was a lot of talk about UFOs, aliens visiting our world, War of the Worlds, Russian threats, and a lot of different conspiracy theories going on. NASA wanted to know what the truth was, and they had this brilliant young scientist, Carl Sagan, and so they extended him a grant that would conduct research about the possibility of aliens visiting Earth. They presumed that the result would be that Sagan would come back and say it's impossible. And so he transferred over to Palo Alto. He was at Berkeley at the time. He went over to Palo Alto to Stanford, and he was in the genetics department led by a personal friend of his, Joshua Lederberg. And over the next year, he crafted the paper that I'm discussing. And the result of that paper was that Carl Sagan concluded that there was a high possibility that extraterrestrials not only exist, but that they have visited Earth many times, in fact, over the geological ages, as many as 10,000 times, and that the probability that they have visited Earth in historic times was very high. And so he submitted that paper back to NASA. It was peer-reviewed and published in a scientific journal, and then it effectively disappeared, as you said. Very, very few people over the past 30, 40, 50 years have known about that paper. I've not met anybody to date that has told me that they knew about the paper, that they referenced the paper, they studied the paper, they wrote about the paper. Even people that are into ancient alienism, even the skeptics who should have known about that paper, no one has stepped forward yet and said that they have written about or spoken about that paper. So in that sense, it has been suppressed.
As a young child, Sagan was, fascinated by, the possibility of UFOs. In 1947, when Kenneth Arnold saw the flying saucers, Sagan would have been 9, 10. He even wrote, was it a U.S. senator asking for them to investigate this phenomenon? Was it a senator he wrote to as a child?
Yes. He had a remarkable capacity to envision all the great possibilities of the vast universe we live in. At the same time, he understood the extreme discipline that it takes to be a scientist. And so you're looking at two extremes. that really only the best scientists have, and that is the ability to expand your mind to consider all possibilities. And yet at the end of the day, you have to know that you have to be able to produce testable evidence to verify and confirm your claim. And so he was able to do both. And so, yes, his vision included the possibility of UFOs, that Earth is a visited planet. At the other extreme, he knew that there was a very strict, highly disciplined, rigid guideline that he had to attend to. And that's what that's the kind of scientist that he was.
But as I remember Sagan from that amazing series Cosmos on PBS, one of the most watched series in history on public television, mm-hmm. I think somewhere around a half a billion people saw that. I remember him as being a skeptic, and this is, you know, 30 years, well, he died about 30 years, 34 years after that paper was published, but I remember him, I think many people remember him, as an ardent skeptic.
Right. You have to understand the position that Carl Sagan was in. He owed his ability to practice science to NASA. It wasn't like going from one corporation to another. There was not that option. There was only one opportunity to do space science, and that was through NASA. And so when NASA suppressed his Ancient Alien paper early on, I believe they told him in no uncertain terms that they wanted none of it. For him to get on the bandwagon and espouse his theory of ancient alienism would have put him and his career in dire jeopardy. You can go back in history and think of people like Galileo, Copernicus, and Newton. Their authority was the church. They had to be extremely careful what they said. In their case, if they said the wrong thing, if they said what they really believed, it could have cost them their life. In Carl Sagan's case, he had to walk that fine line where he could not openly talk about his belief in ancient aliens, but if you look carefully at all of his writings, almost all of his writings, he'd put in little snippets of possibilities about all the suns and all the planets and all the possibility of there being extraterrestrial life and that maybe some of them are spacefaring. And then he would leave it at that. He'd go on to something else. It was his way of kind of teasing the establishment. And if you look and read carefully, you would be aware that Carl Sagan never retracted his belief in ancient aliens.
And how is it possible that this scientific paper, peer-reviewed, published in a highly reputable scientific journal, was lost, essentially, and you managed to uncover it? How did that happen?
Around 2007, somewhere in there, I was reading a book by science writer George Vassalis. It's called Civilized Life in the Universe. I love to read science books, and especially about space science. And in that book, George had a paragraph about Carl Sagan and this particular paper. And he pointed out very specifically that this was not just kind of an off-guard paper or Carl Sagan rambling. He said this was a scientific paper that was peer-reviewed and published in a legitimate scientific journal. And in it, he suggested that Earth has been visited up to 10,000 times by extraterrestrials. Well, I was reading through this, and I kept on reading. It didn't really strike me. I mean, it didn't sink in, because I thought I knew Carl Sagan well, and it just didn't sink in. And about three or four pages later, it finally struck me, and I thought, did I just read what I just read? And I turned back over to it and read it again and again, probably a half a dozen times. And I said, why haven't I heard of this paper? I've never heard of this paper. And I'm assuming that George Vassalis knew what he was talking about. So I said, I got to get my hands on this paper. So I went down to the local library research department, and I said, I'm trying to find a paper written by Carl Sagan. I don't know the title of it, but it is about extraterrestrials and extraterrestrials visiting planet Earth. They said, we'll get right on it, but we don't know if we can find it. So we recommend that you also go up to the college library and talk to their research department, because they have connections to other research departments and other colleges. So I did that. So I had two research departments working on trying to find this paper. About 6 weeks later, I got a call from the college library and said, "We're sorry, Mr. Zagudis, we haven't been able to find the paper that you're looking for." Well, I thought if the college couldn't find it, there was no way that the local library research could find it. But 2 weeks after that, I got an email from the researcher at the local library, and she had found it. She put on where I could find it on the web, and when I went to it, I was absolutely floored, and I was overjoyed, and I knew then that I would be spending the next several years kind of tracking down why that paper hasn't been disseminated. It's a brilliant paper. It is scientifically robust. It is a remarkable paper, and it deserves global distribution in my mind. And that's really how I came across it.
And we should point out, Donald, that you have reprinted the paper in your book, The Sagan Conspiracy, NASA's Untold Plot to Suppress the People's Scientists' Theory of Ancient Aliens.
Yes, it's in its entirety. It's not abridged at all. And it was not easy to get permission to put that in, but we got it. And it's in there in the appendix.
So NASA and the Pentagon weren't that effective in suppressing it. I mean, why would they have even allowed it to be printed? Did they not get to see it before it was published?
Well, they produced the grant, that enabled it to be written. I'm assuming that when it was finished, because it was written with a NASA grant, that it was turned over to NASA and it was put in their archives. And that's where it's still at today. It's also in the Seth MacFarlane archives, Carl Sagan archives in Washington, D.C. But again, unless you know the title, it's almost impossible to find. And as you said in your introduction, suppression is not destruction. I never claimed that the paper was destroyed. It was only suppressed because NASA and the Pentagon did not want an Earth-based strategy that would take resources away from them and put it into Earth-based sciences like archaeology and anthropology. And so, again, the proof that it's been suppressed is the very fact that no one seems to know that it existed. Otherwise, everybody would be talking about it and writing about it. And even in Sagan's official biography written by Kay Davidson, he just faintly alludes to the existence of that paper without really ever mentioning it by name or being explicit about it in any way. So that's why I contend that it's a conspiracy.
And between 1962, when this paper was published, and his death in 1996, Sagan himself never referenced it. No one asked him about it.
He did reference it in one book where he just said, I forget exactly how he said it, but he said, I had written earlier about the possibility that Earth is a visited planet, but I have to remind everybody that it would take ironclad evidence to confirm it. And I wish I had that quote in front of me. I do not. But he did mention it explicitly at that point. And as you said, he said that the odds that Earth has been visited is vanishingly small. But again, he had to guard himself, his career. He had to walk that fine line between his career as a NASA scientist, as a leading NASA scientist, as the most famous scientist in the world, and his secret belief in ancient alienism. And I can only appreciate, how difficult that was for him to do.
It must have been excruciatingly painful in a certain respect to...
I don't think that he could even share that information with his closest friends, possibly not even his own family. Although the paper that he was working on when he died had to do with extraterrestrials and spacefaring alien civilizations. And it was almost like, okay, I know I'm going to die, and this is my swan song. This is what I want to leave the world, to let them know that throughout the course of my life, from the very beginning of my career to the very end, I believed in ancient aliens.
Well, this plot, this conspiracy to suppress Carl Sagan and his passionate views about the ancient alien theory may have cost him very dearly. He may have, in fact, paid the ultimate price, as we'll discover when my conversation with Donald Zagutis continues, author of The Sagan Conspiracy. Here is Charles Bradley taking us into the break with The World is Going Up in Flames, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, that was an Archie's tune, I believe, but no, it's Tina's now. Tina and Ike. Let's leave Ike out of it, shall we? Scientists studying the vocal anatomy of a monkey managed to create a nightmarish simulation of what the creature might sound like if it spoke English. The haunting soundbite is derived from the new research at Princeton University, which suggests that Planet of the Apes may not be as far-fetched as previously thought. And if you dare, you can listen to the audio. Our webmaster tonight, Greg Bishop, has posted it in the highlights section up at coasttocoastam.com. And just a warning, once you hear what a monkey might sound like if it spoke English, you can never unhear it, if you know what I mean. Finally, a dating and friendship site to meet others with similar interests. Find your match that shares an interest in the paranormal, science, life after death, ghost stories, Bigfoot, UFOs, alternative medicine, and conspiracy theories. It's free to sign up. Be sure to grab the apps in the App Store, ParanormalDate.com. ParanormalDate.com. Remember, you are not alone. When we come back, more of my conversation with Donald Zagutis, who charges NASA with conspiring against Carl Sagan to keep knowledge of his belief in ancient aliens away from the public. That and more awaits on the other side, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. Richard Serrett coming to you live from Coast Toronto Affiliate Talk Radio AM 640. Donald Zagutis is with us and the author of The Sagan Conspiracy. The Sagan Conspiracy, NASA's untold plot to suppress the people scientists' theory of ancient aliens. So again, what makes this book such a bombshell, Donald, is that it indisputably proves the people scientist, Dr. Carl Sagan, until his death, believed in ancient aliens. And yet, he spent some time taking people like Eric von Daniken and I'm not sure if he corresponded with Zachariah Sitchin or publicly sort of critiqued him, but while he held this passionate view that yes, we have been visited by ancient aliens, at the same time he was critiquing other ancient alien theorists like von Daniken and Sitchin, was he not?
Yes, he was, but it's very important to note, Richard, that he was not objecting to the fundamental premise. He was objecting to their methodology, and that's a whole different ballgame. Ancient alienism is basically run by citizen scientists, and they don't really feel compelled to abide by the scientific standards of evidence, and they admit that. Even today, if you look at the History Channel, they talk about mainstream scientists versus what they call ancient alien theorists. So it's like two different ball games. One plays softball, one plays hardball. Carl Sagan was a established scientist. He played hardball. And his problem with ancient alien people like von Daniken was that he thought they were playing softball.
So then, in light of who Sagan was, just help help me and our listeners then to understand the import of this finding, because I'm thinking, imagine now these citizen scientists, as you call them, and all these disclosure advocates, imagine if they had the gravitas of someone like Dr. Carl Sagan behind them, or rather in front of them, leading the charge.
Yeah, that's a great observation, and I'm still waiting to hear from leading spokesman for the conventional ancient alien movement. I know they're reading my book. They're digesting it. I'm sure they're going over Carl Sagan's research, not only in that Stanford paper, but a few years later, he co-authored a book called Intelligent Life in the Universe with a Russian scientist. And a couple of those chapters in that book specifically talk about his belief in ancient aliens as well. This could be a very disturbing moment for popular ancient alien proponents, because if they recognize Carl Sagan, who wrote his material years before Eric von Daniken wrote Chariot of the Gods, they would basically be acknowledging that Carl Sagan is kind of like the godfather of ancient alienism. And I'm not sure they're prepared to do that. And also, the Stanford paper would be like a foundational document. As you said, it would be a cornerstone document that would scientifically justify the search for evidence of ancient aliens here on Earth. And I'm not sure that ancient alien leaders are prepared to embrace that. I think that they're pretty content with where they're at, and I have a problem with where they're at, because I think that if we're going to do anything with this movement, that at some point in time, we need to follow the scientific method. We need to get tough. We need to up our standards, up our game, and we need to provide what the scientific community is asking us to provide, and that is testable, replicable evidence that can be independently analyzed and gone over and scrutinized, and that's not where the ancient alien community is at. I believe that they have a process that they're content with, where they go around the world collecting various curiosities, archaeological, geological, historical curiosities, and then they weave a narrative around those things that involve extraterrestrials. Well, it's entertainment. Now they've got great visual effects. They've got better narration. They've upped their game in a lot of different ways. They've got slick magazines and websites, but they really haven't gone in the direction of mainstream science. And if they bought into the Sagan paper, into the Sagan methodology, I don't know that they would be willing to do that. I would like to think they would, but I haven't heard from anybody yet, and so that remains to be seen.
It is curious. I would think that, let's leave the ancient alien theorists aside for a moment and just talk about the disclosure advocates, people like Stephen Bassett, and those that are trying to push the needle in the direction of the U.S. government, for example, you know, finally disclosing what they know about UFO incursions into North American airspace. I would think that they would give their eye tooth to have someone like Dr. Sagan in their corner.
Yeah, I hope you're right, Richard. I would love to believe that's the way it's going to be. The Stanford paper creates a platform, a science-based platform, where those who are interested in the subject, those who are serious about the subject, can submit their evidence to a scientific organization that would agree to evaluate or to test that information. That's the potential. Now, whether the ancient alien community accepts that or goes in that direction, I don't know. But I do know one thing. I have a tremendous amount of research material that is not in this book. I'm talking to my agent right now about a Sagan trilogy that would go ahead and build on this first book, The Sagan Conspiracy, and move in the direction that you're talking about specific evidence that is testable and replicable that could move us closer to finding the smoking gun that would scientifically confirm that extraterrestrials exist and have been to Earth.
You talk about, testable evidence and the fact that Sagan applied the scientific method to this field, which is, largely speculative, and it is, at least as practiced by the citizen scientists,
Right.
it is, I mean, there is some very compelling circumstantial evidence. So I'm wondering, how did he apply the scientific method to the ancient alien theory? What evidence did he have? Did he discover direct evidence of past alien visits?
I don't believe early on that he had hard evidence. I do believe there's a possibility that before he died that he found hard evidence and that he may have been preparing to share that with the world, although I can't prove that. What he did do was he laid a theoretical foundation for the search process, just as the radio telescope search at the beginning did not have any hard evidence. Yet there was a paper written by scientist Giuseppe Cocconi and Philip Morrison from Cornell University that suggested that since we had the radio telescope that was a newly invented tool, that we might want to use that tool to listen to things coming in from outer space to see if we could intercept an alien signal. Frank Drake, who was also a Cornell scientist, picked up on that. In fact, he had already been working on that possibility, but he kept it a secret. So there was a foundation for the experiment, but there was no hard evidence that had yet been detected. Well, SETI's been going on for more than a half a century now, and they still, and they acknowledge this, they haven't found any hard evidence. They've never found a signal. And after 50 years, after more than 50 years, there's a lot of people that have given up on the radio telescope experiment. The fact is that Carl Sagan laid the foundation for an experiment, but it was never implemented. And at the beginning, I don't believe he had the hard evidence, but let's face it, his search strategy was never implemented. If it had been implemented as it should have been, like the radio telescope experiment, we might now today have the hard evidence that he believed existed, possibly in ancient manuscripts.
So I think you're referring, was it the 1974 Arecibo radio signal experiment? And he and Drake collaborated on sort of the content of that signal, what was to go into that information that was blasted out into space. So he was being set up to fail, is that the idea?
I'm not quite sure I follow you, Richard. Explain that again.
Was the Arecibo radio transmission, was it, I think it was 1974, sometime in there, right? That he and Drake sort of collaborated.
Yes.
Is it the suggestion here then that they knew they were going to fail, or they were set up to fail, that they weren't going to get a return message?
Well, it was basically a radio telescope is like a big ear. It listens. It doesn't project out, although they can convert it over to to send out signals. But basically what they were doing was listening for incoming signals. And that was the only time that Carl Sagan participated in a radio telescope search, just one time. And in that time, they scanned several billion stars and they didn't pick up anything. And Frank Drake, in his book, talks about Sagan looking kind of bored. And I suggested that it was not so much that he was bored, but after a few hours of listening from several billion stars, if they had not picked up an alien signal then, they never would, not in 100 years, not in 1,000 years. Because if there are aliens out there using radio telescopes to transmit signals, the galaxy should be filled with trillions of signals, and it should not be hard at all. You should be able to turn on a radio telescope and be able to detect their signal. NASA sometimes, or SETI, referred to it as looking for a needle in a haystack. But Ray Kurzweil, a Harvard scientist, said that's just not true at all. He said that if there are extraterrestrials out there using electromagnetic communications, and if there are multiple civilizations, as Carl Sagan thought, there should be trillions of needles and all over the universe going back and forth. Even if the civilizations have since gone extinct, those telecommunications would still be out there. So it wasn't so much that he was set up to fail, it's that they didn't find anything, and said he's been looking ever since and still hasn't found anything.
Right, that was, you had the Drake equation, which was calculating how many alien civilizations may be out there, and then the, sort of the response to that, I suppose, was the Enrico Fermi paradox, is, if there are so many of them out there, where are they?
Right. Both of those are tremendous concepts. Enrico Fermi was a professor at the University of Chicago before Carl Sagan became a student there. But Carl was very well aware of Fermi's paradox. In fact, he refers to it in his paper. And also, Carl Sagan was one of 11 men that met at Green Bank, West Virginia. That was the first scientific meeting to discuss the possibility of there being extraterrestrials and possibly extraterrestrials sending signals to planet Earth. They call themselves the Order of the Dolphin, which comes from submarine terminology. But at that meeting, Frank Drake had prepared an equation called the Drake equation that's become one of the most famous equations in ETI history, that calculated the odds of there being advanced extraterrestrials. And it was, you know, the result was, after they talked about it, was between 1,000 and I think 100 million. And so Carl Sagan knew, even at the low end of that, that there was more than enough extraterrestrial civilizations out there that some of them should have visited Earth. And it's very interesting that on SETI's website, if you go to Fermi's Paradox, there is a very significant essay where, after 50 years of denial that extraterrestrials could get to Earth because of the cosmic speed limit and the vast distances involved and the great energy demands, that SETI acknowledges that by all probability that extraterrestrials have had plenty of time to colonize the entire galaxy and have reached Earth. So it was an amazing turnaround, and this essay did not appear until after Carl Sagan died.
Sagan throws out the number 10,000. 10,000
right.
Times ancient aliens may have visited the Earth. What is the methodology for that number? How does he come up with that number?
Well, it's a little bit of more math than I'm capable of explaining. It is in the Stanford paper, and he talks about a number of possible advanced civilizations, and he mentioned long-lived civilizations, and he talks about the size of the galaxy, of the Milky Way galaxy. He talks about the age of the universe. He talks about the age of the Earth. And so he runs all those calculations through his computer-like mind, and he crunches the numbers, and that's what he came up with. And it's interesting because he said that early on that extraterrestrials would visit our planet about once every 1,000 years. And so if he calculated that they've been here 10,000 times in geological history, that would make them 10 million years more advanced than we are. Well, you can possibly, I don't know, it's impossible to imagine, let's face it. It's impossible to imagine what beings 10,000 years more scientifically advanced than we are, what their capabilities would be. We've only been in the age of science for 400 years, and look where we're at. We're already preparing and talking about interstellar spaceflight after 400 years. We're talking about aliens 10 million years beyond us, or even if it was 1 million years, or even 1,000 years, it's hard for us to wrap our heads around what they might be capable of, because scientific progress advances at an exponential rate. It doesn't advance at just a steady rate. It advances exponentially. And so, you know, he calculated that Earth has been visited by extraterrestrials 10,000 times. And by the way, that addresses another belief he had, and that is in terraforming. There's a lot of talk about us terraforming Mars to make it habitable for humans. Carl Sagan believed that Earth is a terraformed planet, and it was terraformed by extraterrestrials to make it livable for humanoids and eventually humans.
It'd be interesting, we're just heading into a break here shortly, it would be interesting to hear what Carl Sagan would have to say about Brandenburg's work uncovering evidence for a nuclear blast on Mars millions of years ago, and his theory that that's what obliterated the atmosphere. We'll take a time out, we'll come back, and this conspiracy perpetrated by NASA and the Pentagon against Carl Sagan may just be about to take a very dark turn when my conversation with Donald L. Zygutis returns after this. And here is Jeff Lynne and ELO dusting off an old Chuck Berry chestnut, their take on Roll Over Beethoven, right here on Coast to Coast AM.